Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. My name is Kieran Tavam. Been a little while since our last episode. Apologies, been a busy time for myself and my co-host over in the United States, JJ Duke. JJ, how are you, mate?
Kieran, it's very good. Busy times, interesting times over the last few weeks, I think, for a number of reasons. But good to be back. Good to get things up. And boy, it's been a very busy period.
Yeah, it's been a few weeks since our last episode. And oddly, we're doing this show over Skype, despite the fact that we were in each other's company all of a week ago at the She Believes Cup. And it should be the She Believes Cup that we start with. And JJ, after what can only be described as a disastrous tournament for the US last year, they've come back with a vengeance this year, ended it undefeated, and claimed the title. From your perspective, how do you evaluate and review the US performances at She Believes?
Yeah, I think it was a performance that a lot of people expected. Go get results. Let's face it, this tournament against the best teams of the world, you're not going to see a whole lot of one-sided performances. We did have one game at the beginning of the two games in that tournament where you had a little bit of unfavorable score lines, that being England over France 4-1 to begin the tournament, and France and Germany in a match that didn't have any significance for the trophy. Played to a little bit of a rout, but for the U.S., they went out and grinded out results. Sometimes you're not going to be upset the fact that they didn't play as free-flowing football as you'd think that they would, but I think there were a lot of good things to take away from the tournament. There were some notable individual performances, I think, that Jill Ellis will be happy about. So I think you put this down as a check mark for them and a job well done.
Who would you say those individual performances that stood out were?
Well, I think, if you go back onto the Women's Soccer Zone website, did a piece on Tierna Davidson, who stepped in very nicely for Becky Sauerbrunn, the center back position. I mean, when you're going in inclusion to this tournament, four career starts and matching up against, in order, Nadia Nadim, Jennifer Marazan, Eugenie Le Sommer, and the attacking monster that is the England front line right now, I think she held herself very well accountable. Three solid performances, working well with Abby Dahlkemper. She is one. I think Mallory Pugh had a very good tournament, obviously got the opening goal in the 1-1 draw against France. Those were the two, Kieran, and you can add in any others if you want, but those are the two that stood out most particularly for me.
Yeah, Tierna Davidson, definitely the standout for me with the US, 19 years old. As you've already said, go to the Women's Soccer Zone website. There's a good interview with her on there. I think you did that after the second game, didn't you, against France? But I thought she was excellent, you know, very much showed a maturity, a lot older than her years, and she could potentially be in that US squad for a very long time. But we know that centre-back position, there's a lot of competition in the US, but I thought she was very good. I wouldn't say that there were what I would describe as too many outstanding performances, but I thought the US did well as a team in this tournament. You know, they went undefeated, they got the win over Germany in the first game. Draw was a little bit disappointing against the French, considering they were coming off of an absolute hammering from England, which we'll talk about in a minute. But then to go and beat England in that final game, and England didn't really show up in that final game, if we're honest. I don't really remember them having that many clear-cut chances. I think Ellen White had a header at the end, didn't she, that was, I think, cleared off the line. But other than that, I thought the US were pretty much in control of that game. So I thought they did okay, mate. I don't think they were outstanding, but they did what they needed to do to get the results.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember, when you get into major competitions, sure, you want to be peaking and hitting all cylinders, but you can't expect to win in that tournament seven clear-cut matches. There are going to be some peaks and some valleys. So, you know, when you go out and get results, 7 points out of a possible nine, I don't think you can be too upset if you're a U.S. fan how this was going about. And it's going to set a nice little bit of groundwork for this unit as they get closer and closer to a World Cup qualifying in the CONCACAF tournament coming up later in the fall.
Well, England finished second And they finished second, having gone into that final game against the US, top of the table after a really comprehensive 4-1 win over France. And we can't downplay that, can we? Because we know about England's record against France. They got their first win in pretty much 40 years at the Euros last year over France in the knockout phase. And then to go and beat them 4-1 in the opening game of She Believes. Now, we know that Corinne Diacre, the French head coach, is going for a bit of a transition with her squad. There's a lot of young players in that team. They've lost a few of the more experienced heads over the last year. But for England to go and win that game 4-1, it set the benchmark for the rest of the tournament. And although they didn't actually go on to win the competition, they of course got the 2-2 draw with Germany in the second game, coming back twice. Ellen White, superb in that match. England can be pleased, can't they, with their tournament performances, because they've got more points than they ever have done in the tournament. They've got more goals than they ever have done in the tournament, and they got their highest position that they ever have done in the tournament. So despite not winning it, they have to be pleased with how they perform, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the big one to that is the fact that they're playing under a new manager for the first time in quite a while. And, you know, there was a lot of speculation, and you know this very well from sitting down with him in his first real media gathering when he was appointed as the head coach. And there was a lot of questioning about how this team would look, who would he put out onto the field, and what type of style would they play. And, you know, that was a great tone setter in that first 30 minutes against France, where Tony Duggan hits 7 minutes in, then Jill Scott finishes one off right before the half hour mark, and they just continued on playing. You talked about that Germany game where they had a couple of shaky moments there, but you know what? They never gave in. They never went down on themselves after trailing twice in that match, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, they grinded out a point there. And when we talked with Phil Neville after the second match against Germany, he's not afraid in playing some of his younger players, a little bit of an ode to when he first came through the ranks at Manchester United in that vaulted and famed class of 92. He's not afraid to go deep into the system, give players opportunities. And I think there are a number of players that maybe etch themselves just a little bit further up the depth chart as we go into the back half of their World Cup qualifying campaign.
Yeah, I think Keira Walsh is one of those, the Man City holder midfielder, you know, 20 years old. I think she played in the first and the third game and outstanding. I thought she did not look out of her depth at all against three of the best teams in the world. And I think she's only going to get better. I think she's a future star for this English team. I thought Abby McManus did really well, considering she came into the squad really late, obviously replacing Steph Horton. It was probably at the back that England had the most problems. I know they conceded the one against France, they had the two against Germany, the one against the US. It wasn't necessarily the fact they conceded the four goals, it was the manner of those goals, wasn't it? Gaëtan Tinez was heavily deflected. There was an own goal in the game against Germany, there was an own goal in the game against the USA. That's something that they'll want to stamp out, because they were avoidable goals in some cases, and I think they'll be disappointed there. But I agree with you, there were some standout performances. I thought they did really well, and as I say, Abby McManus and Keira Walsh for me particularly impressed, considering they are, you know, new to the international scene. France finished third, and after the disastrous start against England, to get the draw against the US and then to, if we're honest, tear apart the Germans, who were dreadful in that final game, it gave them something to work on and to build on, didn't it? Because the problem they have is that, being the hosts of the World Cup next year, they're not going to have as many, I guess, opportunities to play what we would describe as competitive games. But we also know that sometimes these World Cup qualifiers aren't that competitive, so it might be that they can arrange some higher profile friendlies to make sure they're ready for next year.
Yeah, and I think that was the point that I really brought up last year in the build-up to the Euros with the Netherlands, is, you know, they did kind of benefit from the fact that they had that Olympic qualification tournament nearly making the Olympics as well, so at least they got a little bit of their juices under them. You're right in where France, they can schedule some higher-profile friendlies, but I still think, honestly, and this is just my opinion, that friendlies, no matter who you play, the result isn't always going to be the biggest thing they'll come out to you. It's more of the performances of the players. And if we're speaking just on that alone, we're going to go in the latter two matches of the She Believes Cup. I think they responded beautifully. Corinne Diacre was very upset and furious with her team. If, you know, let's be real here, she wasn't happy with how they played against England. Obviously, conditions were very adverse in Columbus, but they responded beautifully against the U.S. when Pugh scored, which was, in essence, just a scramble inside the 18. Le Sommer does what she does best, uses her pace, gets around the keeper, puts it home, and then they put together a clinical contest against Germany in a game where Germany never really felt like they were in it at all. So I think France, they'll be pleased with how they responded, pleased how they finished off that tournament. And then you have to look, you know, when's going to be the next time that they're going to be playing teams like this again? It could be a while. That, as you say, they'll have some friendlies coming up, but outside of maybe a similar tournament like this next year, this might be really their lone competition away from, you know, things that they know, close proximity to their training grounds, playing within their nation. This will probably be their best preparation for the tournament. Now the question is going to be, what is that France team going to look like come next summer?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of young players in that squad at the moment, so it would have been good experience for them. But plenty of time to build. We're over a year away from the World Cup. And as I say, after that performance against England, did manage to redeem themselves with the two results against the Germans and the Americans. Now, we'll talk about the Germans in a minute, but obviously it'd be good to get some reaction from She Believes Cup. So after the final game, I managed to get some quotes in the mix zone from Lucy Bronze, who was the standing captain for England, about how she felt the tournament had gone, and from Morgan Bryan. So it was good to catch up with her to get her view, having returned to the national team in quite some time, to see how she felt that her team did. And when we come back, we will have a chat about Germany, because there was some big news concerning Steffi Jones after that tournament.
At the end of that, as captain,
I'm really proud of everyone that's not only just stepped on the pitch, but everyone that's been here. You know, a lot of the girls, the first couple caps for England, and they've all put in a really good shift and all deserve to be picked for England. And I think Phil's got a hard job picking the squads for the future camps, but at the same time, obviously we're disappointed that we had it in our hands at the end and we've just let it slip, and a very unfortunate way to get beat as well. With all the goals that we've conceded this tournament have been kind of unlucky. We've been on the end of a lot of bad luck, but hopefully that'll turn around at some point. But I think, you know, we're starting to build, we're starting to play good football, and this is just the beginning.
Does the gap feel bridgeable between you and the States?
Yeah, I don't even feel like there is a gap. I mean, you're looking, last year was 1-0 to us, this year was 1-0 to them through a deflected goal. Last year was a last minute kerfuffle in the box pretty much. So I think it's go either or on the night, and obviously went their way tonight. But I think we know that we can be a lot better. I think the US are maybe at their peak. They have been for a long time. I think the French and Germans, you know, they all know what they bring as a team, what kind of team they are, what they're going to get from them. I think we're kind of at the beginning of that. I think Mark Sampson pushed us a long way, but now Phil's took over and he's really getting an extra yard out of us, so much more out of us, and I think we've got so much more to give than any other team in the world.
I think there's momentum, isn't there? It's just kind of, you've stepped up a level and that momentum started for the next sort of 18 months.
Exactly. I know we've drawn and we've beaten, but we still feel like we've got a lot of momentum behind us, and you know, Phil's only had a week to coach us, and we've got out a brilliant result against France, a good performance against Germany, and then just missed out today. So, you know, we're definitely at the start of something really, really good. And if this is how good we are after 1 week, you know, it's exciting to see after a year and a half where we're going to be at for the World Cup.
Have you enjoyed the opportunity to be the skipper, be that leader? And
I mean, I've spoke with Steph and Jordan a couple of times this week, because I think it's a little bit harder than you realise. To kind of, I feel like I'm everyone's babysitter sometimes, asking me 100 questions. But on the pitch, I love it, and I love setting an example for the girls. And I think a lot of people have stepped up this week to try and, you know, help the inexperienced girls, help lead on the field. But off the field, yeah, it's a change of manager, a change of scenery, a change of faces. I think I've probably had a little bit more to deal with than Steph normally does, so I've been complaining to her a little bit, telling her to hurry up and get back. But it's been good, and I think it's been good for me as a person and as a player to grow a little bit more.
There's a lot made when Phil took the job on, that he had no experience in women's football. You've worked with him now for a week or two. Have you noticed any differences in the way that he's approached things? Have you noticed the fact that he had no experience in the women's game? How's it been different to maybe coaches you've worked with before?
Not really. I think the only difference will be is that anyone else who's involved in the women's game will be like, oh my god, this is the USA, this is Germany, this is France. Phil's coming in with a clean slate and he's looking at them purely as a footballer. He's not looking at their reputations, you know, who's that, who's this, who's in the limelight. It doesn't matter for Phil, it's right, who's the best players, who's going to perform the best, what are their team, you know, Carly Lloyd, whoever it might be, it doesn't matter. He's watching them for the football because he might not have watched them for the last couple of years. So in that respect, I think it's kind of refreshing and it's kind of a good thing that in women's football we do get caught up with names and Phil doesn't, because he's obviously not been in the game that long.
Do you think his big name in men's football, do you think it could bring more attention, obviously more media and more perhaps eyes on the women's game and your team, whether it be good or bad?
Well, I think from the beginning it already had that, you know, straight away it was Phil Neville, everyone was talking about it. Then 2 days ago it was, oh my god, David Beckham's come to see him. Do you think David Beckham would come and see anyone else? But obviously he's played with Phil before, so I think obviously he's going to bring a little bit more attention, whether it's good or bad. I think we're probably going to get scrutinised and criticised a little bit more if we don't do well. But then at the same time, I think when we do well, I think it'll probably magnify that at the same time. So it's good and bad, and all the girls are enjoying having him at the minute, and obviously everyone enjoyed seeing David Beckham.
I'm interested to know, Lucy, obviously I was in Lyon a few weeks ago to watch your game against Montpellier. I'm kind of interested to know how your experience there early days is maybe impacting or influencing your international career at the moment, playing with those players that you're playing.
It's definitely different. I think it's harder now to come in to England, to settle back into the team, to settle in with a completely different set of players who play a different way. You know, before I was always saying, yeah, I play with Steph week in, week out, I play with KB week in, week out, and it was an easier transition, whereas I've tried to improve my game as an individual, but then it's still difficult to come in and slot in when I'm used to playing with completely different people and speaking a different language even as well. So I think it's been a little bit of a hard transition. I think the first couple of days here have been hard for me as well, especially taking on the captaincy. But I think in the long run, it's only going to make me better, and hopefully if I improve as a player, then England will improve as a team as well.
You've been very positive, but you're absolutely good, yeah. Personally.
Yeah. I think if there was a camera stood on me, I was stood with my arms folded for about 20 minutes with the biggest frown ever, like someone's just took the sweets off me.
Mo, after the disappointment of Sheba Leaves Cup last year, how important was it to not only win the competition but win it undefeated?
Yeah, it was really important, I think, especially this team. You know, last year we didn't have the result we wanted to, and so I think to come out and play three really good teams and get the result is something we wanted to do, and obviously the performance to go with it, and so I think it was a good end to the tournament.
When you look at the three games, how do you not assess them individually but as a collection, what do you think went well, maybe what do you think you need to work on?
Yeah, I think at this point in time, you know, we're kind of at the beginning of trying to form what we want to be, and I think these three teams and opponents that we played are huge for showing us exactly what we need to work on, and I think, you know, for us it's kind of gelling together more, and I think, you know, consistency and performances is huge for us, and I think especially going into big tournaments like we are soon.
And what about you as an individual? More minutes on the pitch, got a 90 against France in the last game, got a few today. We talked about small victories in the interview that we did when you were in Lyon. When you look at your Sheba Leaves Cup, how do you assess that?
Yeah, small victories. I think this is a big victory for me in terms of just playing in games, and you know, I haven't really played a 90-minute game or started a game for the national team, I think, and since Sheba Leaves last year. So, if I'm right, I think. And so for me, I think it's, like you said, small victories, but huge. And to get minutes, and these games are very close back-to-back, and a lot of traveling too. So I think for me, it was good to get those minutes under my belt and back in with the team, and you know, hopefully moving forward from here.
Has it felt different, preparation this time around? You talked about the travel. Obviously, you'd normally be coming into a US camp. Well, not having really played any soccer, because obviously the NWSL hasn't started yet. You've got a few games, a few months under your belt in Lyon. Did you maybe not feel better prepared for this one, but was the preparation a little bit different?
Yeah, I think so. I felt played in coming in terms of, you know, being on the ball, and obviously I've still been coming back from injury. So it wasn't like I was playing from January 1st on. You know, I was coming back into the full month of January and then got my first minutes in February. So I think that, you know, coming in I felt good, and, you know, I think it was a good camp and a good step forward.
And now going back to Lyon, how will this She Believes Cup kind of help you going back to your club?
Yeah, I think these matches were, you know, high-level matches, and I think for, you know, for me, that's kind of what I need right now in terms of getting back onto the pitch, and so this is exactly what I need at this point in time, and hopefully, you know, going back to Lyon will help in my performances.
And the conversations with Lucy Bronze, Jennifer Marajan, your French teammates, how are they going to go down?
I don't know. We'll see when we get back.
So, JJ, we left Germany till last because they finished bottom, 1 point, winless in the She Believes Cup. And as a result, head coach Steffi Jones has lost her job less than 2 years after taking over from Sylvia Naid. It doesn't really come as a surprise, does it? Because it wasn't just the results that were bad in that tournament. They didn't play very well either, did they?
No, they didn't. I think this really kind of spans back to what the teams look like post the Rio Olympics. I mean, Germany was Germany in Brazil. They took care of business. They weren't always the most eye-pleasing team to watch, but they found the way to get the results. Ever since then, mate, and I know you've seen them both in person, you've seen that on television enough in major competitions to know that this team just didn't look connected. Obviously, this tournament, you know, provides a nice little ground for some of those young players. We obviously spoke with the United States, with England, and France are doing sort of the same thing and trialing a lot of new players. Germany, they have lost a lot of experienced players. Obviously, Melanie Behringer, amongst others, no longer in the outfit. But you'd figure that Germany is kind of one of those teams that they don't rebuild, they kind of just reload. Their system has always been very strong over the years, and players that maybe didn't get the chance under Sylvia Naid were getting the opportunities under Steffi Jones. But maybe you have to start thinking, Kieran, that maybe Sylvia Naid was onto something when some of these players that are getting time right now, and this is no knock on them, but they just aren't ready for playing at the international stage. And Germany, not to say that they're going to be any danger of missing out on any major international tournaments, but yeah, this is not the team that we're used to seeing.
No, and let's not forget, this isn't based purely on She Believes Cup. They didn't do very well in the Euros last year. They are in danger of finishing runners-up in their World Cup qualification group. Obviously, they've already lost to Iceland in that group, and like you say, they look disjointed, and yes, they are much like France in a bit of a transitional phase with having to bring some young players in to replace some of those retired individuals. But I kind of almost feel that Steffi Jones needed to be, I hate comparing it to the men's game, but it's a little bit like when David Moyes replaced Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United. It's how do you follow on from someone who has been so successful in a role when you have it all to, you know, you're having to do it off the back of retirements and not necessarily having the level of player that were available under the previous coach. And Steffi Jones may be that she has suffered as a result of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I believe also that really kind of stands for any sort of person taking over who's been in a long-standing post for a while, whether it's sport or not. It's not the replacement, it's the replacement for the replacement that usually figures it out. And it's unfortunate because Steffi Jones, I mean, you don't really have to go into detail and what she has meant to not only the women's game, but the game in Germany as well. Highly respected, but the timing just doesn't work out. And maybe it might be one of those things that the crop of players that were next coming through the system, not to say that they were equal to because they're their own unique outfit, but they might not be able to really gain what German football is about and what they're trying to achieve. So yeah, it's tough. You know, obviously things could change at the drop of a hat. They can figure it out very quickly. I still think that they're not going to have any issues qualifying for the World Cup Cup, even though they have to go get some results that they probably weren't figuring that they needed to go get, one of those being away to Iceland in early September. But now that that being said, as long as in their minds they're turning up next summer in France with a team that they think can win the tournament, then usually it's about status quo.
Yeah, totally agree. Shame for Steffi Jones, but interesting times for Germany. Now, we know that the tournament was heavily disrupted by bad weather. Again, there were chartered flights that had to be taken from Columbus to New York for teams because all flights were grounded due to the bad weather in Columbus and the bad weather in New York. It wasn't the only place that had bad weather. The Algarve, which traditionally should have nice weather at this time of year, the Algarve Cup had to be shared, didn't it, mate? Because the two finalists, Sweden and the Netherlands, couldn't play their fixture because of heavy rain and a waterlogged pitch. So a bit of an anti-climax over in the Algarve, wasn't it? With the Dutch European champions and the Swedes not even being able to kick a ball in their final.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing, right? But people do have to remember the fact that these are quote-unquote friendly tournaments played within a FIFA window. And once March 8th came around, the players had to go back to their clubs. So yeah, it's disappointing. I think, you know, the Netherlands and Sweden, they performed very well in that tournament, and we'll break it down a little bit in a moment, but I think they'll be a bit disappointed that they didn't have a chance to square off against each other, because let's face it, doesn't matter what time of the year or which tournament it is, when you have now the Netherlands and Sweden, which are a couple of the best teams in Europe going at it, that's pretty good watching for the neutral observer.
Yeah, Sweden obviously were slightly disappointing at the Euros last year, weren't they? And I think it's fair to say didn't get to the stage that they would have liked to have. But you're right. I mean, they had a good Algarve Cup getting to the final, beat Canada, who are, you know, fancied by many to do well at the World Cup next year, although slightly uncertain as to how they're going to shape up with the departure of John Herdman at the back end of last year. You know, Sweden beating Canada, then beating drawing with South Korea and beating Russia, you know, to do that, not easy. And then the Netherlands, they topped their group as well. They won two and drew one. They had a humdinger of a game against Japan, winning 6-2, and don't get a chance to see much of the Algarve Cup. In fact, didn't see any of it because obviously we're in the United States. But, you know, to beat Japan 6-2, and then Japan went and beat Iceland 2-1, and the Netherlands went and beat the Euro 2017 final with a 3-2 win over Denmark, and then drew 0-0 with Iceland. They're continuing, aren't they, the Netherlands? They're not showing in any shape or form that the Euros was a fluke. They're still getting good results against good sides.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's almost kind of the standing tempo of when you get a big result in a big tournament, what are you going to do after for yourself, right? Is there going to be that drop-off, or are you going to continue to build on that? And that's why, not to say that there is a gap, but you saw at times in history of this sport that there were some gaps that were built. Obviously, the United States, after getting the 99 World Cup, they went and, you know, performed well. Obviously, didn't win the next Olympics, but they continued to stay at the level that they were going. Ended up getting a couple of more Olympic gold medals, then obviously winning 2015. Germany went back-to-back. So you know that they obviously elevated their game. And, you know, that's kind of the thing that you're going to have to watch out for here at the Netherlands, is if they can back the European title off with a great World Cup and then get to the Olympics. And then you start to see the Netherlands, you know, not just qualifying and being there, but they're picking themselves and putting themselves as being contenders for every competition that they go for. Yeah, I think that's where you're going to start to see the trend go up. So good start. Now let's see how they can build off of it heading towards the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the other teams that I want to focus on in Algarve, because it's difficult to talk about all of them, Australia and Portugal, because they actually faced each other in their group stage and it ended up level. And then when they faced each other again in, I think it was the third place match or second place? I think it was the third
place
match.
Yeah, third place match.
It was actually the hosts, Portugal, that actually beat Australia. And it was the first defeat that Australia have had in quite some time, over a year, I think. Now, I know that Alan Stadjic used the tournament to rotate players and try a few new things, but Portugal have never really performed, despite it being a home tournament for them. But to go undefeated, beating the opposition that they had, who'd they have in their group? They had Norway, They had China. They beat both of them, both teams from the World Cup in 2015, to draw with Australia in their group and then beat them in that third place match. They have to take a lot of confidence from that, don't they, off the back of a decent Euros last year, and then to perform like this year, maybe a team to watch in the future, mate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at how Portugal has gone about just this tournament alone. They've competed in every edition, and they've almost finished dead last in every edition or near to it. Now, we obviously had the opportunity to watch Portugal really for the first time in a major competition at the Euros last year. And it wasn't that they were the, you know, everyone thought that they were going to be the team that would just be happy to be there. And, you know, they would get routed in all three games, maybe have a close one in their match against Scotland, which I guess if you wanted to call it, that was the third place team or the projected third place team in their group. But they competed in every match. They got results, and now they're starting to build off of it. Last year, you know, in our Euros guide, we had the chance to speak with Amanda Da Costa, who in her short time playing with Portugal really kind of gave us some insight about how major it was for that country to qualify for that tournament and how much growth just from that alone and exposure the program has had. And now you back off of a good European tournament with finally breaking through at home in a major competition where you've never succeeded. Yeah, this is going to do them a lot of favors. Now, they're not in the greatest situation right now in their current World Cup qualifying group, but this can just build towards the next Euros, continue to develop, continue to work through the youth system and try to bring up some products that way. And then you never know, maybe come 2023 for that World Cup, they could be there if everything continues to trend upwards.
Yeah, I totally agree. It'd be interesting to see how they progress after performing so well in the Algarve. Not really any other stories for me out of the competition, mate. As I said, Australia, long unbeaten run for them coming to an end. Got a 4-3 win over Norway in injury time. The defeat against Portugal were no doubt disappointing. They beat China in their group as well. So, you know, a few positive results. All winning runs have to come to an end, or all unbeaten runs have to come to an end. But the winning team from the Algarve Cup in 2017 was Spain, and they weren't in the competition this year because they decided to play in the competition that runs simultaneously to the Algarve over in Cyprus. And they added to the Algarve Cup in 2017 by winning the Cyprus Cup in 2018, beating Italy 2-0 in the final. Now, we saw how disappointing they were at the Euros last year, but a Cyprus Cup and an Algarve Cup sandwiched either side of that gives them something to build on, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, you know, disappointing is them making the knockout stage in the Euros, right? That's, you know, you're thinking for Spain, they've never really gotten anywhere to that level. There were high expectations and they maybe felt just a little bit short of that. But, you know, they've gotten to a World Cup now. They've gotten to a couple of Euros now. They're starting to pick and add into their trophy case some of these, you know, they're illustrious tournaments, but they're still friendly tournaments, but against good competition. You know, the Cyprus Cup has been, you know, when it was just two competitions, it was, in all fairness, the B competition. Now it's starting to get lost a little bit even further in translation when you have the She Believes Cup, and then you have a lot of the big nations going to the Algarve. But you look at the teams that they play, Belgium, up-and-coming team that are making wavelengths, and I think they've got a decent chance of getting to the World Cup. Austria, semifinalists in the Euros. Czech Republic, I mean, out of that maybe might be the low end of that. And then Italy, who they defeated in the final quite convincingly, that's a team that's always been there in the hunt for a Euros, in, you know, trying to make it into the World Cup. Unfortunately, a couple of times didn't go their way through the playoff, amongst others. But yeah, those aren't lightweights that they defeated. So I think that Spain right now, into going with a little bit of transitional look, a few players not with the setup anymore that were in the past, they could take away a lot of positives from this, and they could be poised yet again to make a run towards getting to an international major final and making some things happen when they get there.
Yeah, did it without conceding a goal as well in the whole competition. Won their two matches and a draw in their group, and then beat Italy 2-0 in the final without conceding. So, yeah, good tournament for them to add to the Algarve Cup last year. Not really sure if there's any other talking points for you out of that one, mate. Obviously, Belgium beat South Africa in the other finals day. Korea managed to overcome Switzerland 2-1. Switzerland were held by Wales in their group stage, which was a good result for the Welsh. Austria beat Wales in their finals match on penalties, and Finland won at against Hungary, and the Czech Republic beat Slovakia. Korea DPR, as we've already said, beat Switzerland. So Cyprus Cup is always one that's even more difficult to follow than the Algarve. It's not got maybe the names that the Algarve Cup has got, but what do you think we learn from the results that we see in that competition?
Yeah, I think kind of a little more of the status quo. Like I said, Spain obviously getting there. I think it's a bit of a setback for Austria, trying to really back on their Euros performance. And they've lost pretty much any mental advantage that they have going against Spain, because they're going to be turning around on the next World Cup qualification match day and playing Spain at home, a team that they've already lost to once in that competition. I think, if anything, maybe the other winner might be South Africa, getting a couple of results going their way. It's obviously a little bit of the unexpected, and we're not really sure what to ever expect from that team, but they're starting to, again, get themselves in the picture of making international competition, so getting a few results there. They've got a couple of players from that setup now coming over to play in the NWSL, so I think there could be some positives for them to take, but yeah, that's about it on my end.
Yeah, nothing more from me on the Cyprus Cup. Congratulations to Spain on winning another competition. Well, look, let's have a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about UEFA Women's Champions League, with the quarterfinal stages due to take place next week.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSO Zone.
So, JJ, UEFA Women's Champions League. We've got some big ties in the quarterfinal stages. I think the standout one, obviously, is Lyon, the holders, against a team that has invested heavily since reaching the semi-finals last year, and that is Barcelona. Now, the first leg is in Lyon, with the second leg the week after in Spain. I'm not going to go through these individually asking for predictions, but how do you see that one panning out? Because Lyon, unstoppable at times in this competition. Barcelona, people seem to be giving them a fairly decent chance of maybe not going through, but certainly making a tie of it. I'm kind of interested to know where you sit on that one.
Well, this is definitely a different Barca team from the years past, right? They reloaded their system. A lot more notable names in their roster as opposed to years past. I think you're right. I think this is going to be Lyon taking this, but it's not going to be of their combined four legs previously of winning 30-0. Obviously, that was over Polish side Konin and Bilk Kazigert from Kazakhstan in the first two rounds. Barcelona have actually put together four nice matches as well. 6-0 over Evolvnis in the first round, and then of Gintra in the second round, 9-0. So, I mean, they're finishing off their teams. I think the tempo is going to come from that first match away to Lyon. If they're able to get perhaps the away goal, keep it somewhat close, and when I mean somewhat, Kieran, I'm probably talking the range of 2-3 goals, I think that they have maybe a chance when they go back to the Mini Estadi for the second leg right at the end of March.
I think Lyon have too much. I really do. I think Barcelona will make a game of it, but I think Lyon have too much. I've seen them so many times over the last few years, and I just think they're so far ahead of everyone at the moment. But it'd be interesting to see. The other game that will be interesting for me in this quarterfinal is Chelsea against Montpellier. But Chelsea will have one player missing who's featured in the competition earlier on, and that's Crystal Dunn, because since our last show, Crystal Dunn has been confirmed as leaving Chelsea and will be playing for the start of the NWSL season with the North Carolina Courage. We weren't sure how that one was going to work out, were we? Because we saw the team announced her signing, but then her contract wasn't due to be up until the end of the season, but it looks like there's an agreement that has been made, and Crystal will return early to the North Carolina Courage and break her contract with Chelsea. So before we talk about the game, interested in your take on that one, mate.
Yeah, this is questioning for me, right? We've seen this with a bunch of US players in the past. whether they wanted to come to the NWSL in the early stages or come back. Obviously, most notably, Alex Morgan with Lyon. She elected to stay through the Champions League final. I think you and I were kind of along the agreement, and we knew that it was, what, an 18-month contract that she had. So she was going to be coming back to the league at some point for 2018. But you figured, okay, you might as well stay through the run of Champions League. And if Chelsea make a run for the league title, stay on, finish the season out. And then once the window opens up, you come back. But yeah, leaving for the start of the season, I think I was in the surprise boat a little bit, but it seems that she has felt that this was the right time to start the season fresh. And you can't fault a player for that. It's tough to come in, you know, to a new team regardless, but coming into a team right in the middle of the season is definitely challenging. So she's had the opportunity as we build in towards the first weekend of NWSL action to give her a few days working with the team in training, maybe get an exhibition preseason match in there, and then go. So you can see the positives and the negatives. But yeah, I was personally a bit surprised that she came so early. Yeah,
I was surprised as well. I think it's a strange move to join when you've got potentially three huge ties in the Women's Champions League if you get through to the final. But you did manage to speak to her at the She Believes Cup, didn't you? And she did answer the question about joining the North Carolina Courage a little bit earlier. So here's what she had to say.
Personally, it felt right. I think I wanted to start the NWSL, you know, from the beginning. I didn't think I wanted to play catch up in a sense. And also just going from playing English football to playing in the U.S., it's going to take some transitioning. I think the style of play is definitely different. So for me to jump into a season six, seven games in would have been kind of like a shock. And I also want to give myself some time to kind of just transition. Like I said, I've been technically, I'm going to be on my third preseason in a year, and I just need that kind of mental break to kind of get into it. So, yes.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
So that was Crystal Dunn. JJ, Montpellier, Chelsea. I think it's Chelsea, personally, that will go through in that one. I saw Montpellier against Lyon a few weeks ago. They're a good side. They're a very good side, but I don't think they're at the level of Chelsea.
Well, I think right now, if you look at the path that Chelsea to get there, it's pretty much you continue to get the Giants thrown at you, right? Get through Bayern in the first round, get through Rosengard in the second round, which they went, held their Swedish opposition to no goals through two matches. That's pretty impressive, all things considered. And then what would be waiting in the wings without putting too much into it would be Wolfsburg. So yeah, continually throw the gauntlet at them, but I think that they have managed as well. As you said, that roster is maybe the deepest in the WSL right now, and competing to be one of the top four deepest and most talented in Europe right now.
Agreed. Totally agree, and that's showing with their performances in the WSL at the moment. With the absolute respect to Slavia Praha, I'm not even going to talk about Slavia Praha against Wolfsburg, because I just feel that Wolfsburg are going to win that one so comfortably. I think Slavia have done brilliantly to get to the quarterfinal stage, but I think this is probably their level. I think quarterfinals is, for me, the best they can probably do. If they go through, I will happily hold my hands up and apologise and give them as much coverage as we can in a future show, but I just don't see Wolfsburg slipping up in that one. Maybe you want to make a case for them, mate, but I certainly don't see it.
I've got absolutely nothing whatsoever, I'm afraid. So yeah, it's going to be Wolfsburg for me, by a touchdown and a field goal across two matches.
Man City, Linköping, the final quarterfinal in the tie. Linköping have lost a lot of players since they won the league and qualified for this competition. Magdalena Eriksson, of course, is playing for Chelsea, as is Jonna Andersson. They've lost Claudia Neto and Christina Minder, who have gone to Wolfsburg. I think they struggle, mate. I think they've done well to get to the quarterfinals. I don't think it's going to be as clear-cut as Wolfsburg-Slavia, but I do think Man City go through in that one.
The one thing that I think is going to be holding Manchester City back just a little bit, I know we're going to be talking about this in a moment, is their recent downfall in the Conte Cup final. Now, this is a team in City that shows up in the big matches, got to the semifinal stage last year. Does a couple of key changes maybe slow them down a little bit in their recent run of form? I don't know. I'm with you. I think they progress, but I think this is going to come down to if they can put a good performance in the first leg, no problem. If they struggle, then they could have some issues going towards that second leg.
Yeah, totally agree. Although it'll be interesting, won't it, because they'll have an English striker facing them, because, again, since our last show, it was confirmed that Natasha Dowie has signed for Linköping, so it'll be interesting to see how she gets on. We mentioned a lot of players that have moved clubs during the winter window. Some of those players are going to be cup-tied. Ella Massa, for example, won't be able to play for Wolfsburg because she played for FC Rosengard. Natasha Dowie, I'm pretty certain, will be able to play for Linköping, having been playing in the NWSL for the last couple of years. So be interesting to see how she does against a strong Man City team. Man City look fatigued to me, mate. And that was probably backed up, as you mentioned just a couple of moments ago, with the fact they lost the Continental Cup final over here in England to Arsenal this week, 1-0. It was a goal from Viviana Miedema that gave Arsenal their fifth Continental Cup final, their fifth Continental Cup title. And Man City, to me, never really looked in it, but they weren't at their brilliant best. We've seen City at times play flowing football, absolutely batter teams at times, and they never really got going in that Conti Cup final. I think they had one effort cleared off the line. That was probably about as good as it got for City. A number of their players were away with England at the She Believes Cup. None of the Arsenal players were at She Believes Cup. There were a few players that were obviously on international duty at the Algarve and some of the other competitions that were going on. But I think Arsenal benefited from having those players around. City, as you say, that Champions League tie could come down to how tired or how fresh they are. But I think it was a good win for Arsenal, but City not at their best.
No, City weren't at their best. And yeah, I think what Lisa Evans cleared one off the line about 20 minutes from time. I think a couple of weak efforts at Sari van Veenendaal, but that's about it. Not to say that Arsenal had many chances in their own right. I think Dominic Janssen had one long distance effort rocket off the bar early on. I think she had another set piece from about an equal distance just over. There wasn't much attacking in this match, but I think the one for me, Kieran, obviously you see Arsenal a lot more than I do, is this team is just, they've got a different mentality and a different approach under Joe Montemurro now. They never didn't have belief, I guess I would say, but now these last few matches, they're starting to win. They're stringing together good results. I think, if they've lost since the start of the calendar year, it may have been only once. Since then, they've looked good. They've looked like they want to go out and attack, utilize all this international class that they have. And I think the players right now, after seeing some of the video on social media that they've posted, team talks after, the final whistle, I think they believe that they can still go make a run and try to snatch that second place spot in the league.
Yeah, to me, you're right. I see a lot of Arsenal, and I feel like the players know their role under Joe Montemurro. I kind of felt that under Pedro Losa, certainly towards the end of his tenure, players looked a little bit lost. They didn't really know what their role within the team was. There was some frustration clearly there. When you hear players talk in interviews and certainly post-match after the City game, they talk about how their level has gone up in the last 4 or 5 months. That 4 or 5 months is the time that Joe Montemurro has been there. I've heard from certain players that, things are very different under Joe. They enjoy working with him. Not that I'm saying they didn't enjoy working with Pedro, but I think he's just kind of livened it up a little bit. He's brought some fresh ideas. And not only did they win against Man City, they won with a clean sheet, which is not easy to do against a very, very good City side. They look organised as well. I think that's the important thing. Defensively at times under Pedro, I didn't think they were that great. They looked better defensively. You're right, they didn't create a huge amount, but the chance that they did create, if you've got Viviana Miedema playing up front for you, you've got chances of scoring goals. But they do look better under Joe. And can they snatch that second spot and potentially qualify for the Champions League? There's absolutely no reason why not.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's all about belief at this point, right? And, you and I kind of joked in previous episodes that, wait, we're only still a third of the way through the season, or now at this point only half through the season. Mate, there's enough time. I'm not saying that they can do it, because let's face it, City and Chelsea are a top class, or two top class teams, but there's time. If they can continue to keep the form going, get the results, maybe see some slip-ups from the others. Yeah, I think they've got every right in the world to think that they could go finish second, maybe even pipe dream, but maybe even clinch it. I think they're still in it, and it's not just a two-team race anymore.
No, totally agree. Totally agree. We'll talk about FAWSL in our next episode, and there's been some big results since our last show. Well, winning the Continental Cup after 230 caps for America and a World Cup and Olympic gold was actually the first club domestic cup competition that Heather O'Reilly won. Her former US women's national team teammate, Kristen Press, is making headlines at the moment because it has been revealed in the last week that she will not be playing for the Houston Dash, despite that bumper trade that occurred at the NWSL draft, where Kristen left the Chicago Red Stars to go to Houston, Carly Lloyd and Janine Becky left Houston to go to Sky Blue, and Sam Kerr and Nikki Stanton left Sky Blue to go to Chicago. We all had raised eyebrows when that trade happened. We all questioned whether Kristen Press would actually turn out for the Dash. It doesn't look like she's going to, but we don't know where she's going to end up, do we, JJ?
Nope, not at all. And it's really interesting, Kieran, what this move really means for not only the NWSL, but the national team players that play in the NWSL. We've often heard, maybe behind the scenes rumors more than anything else, that the players right now are really kind of making their own moves from themselves. Now, we're not talking National Basketball Association, like where you have LeBron James kind of dictating the trades, who goes where, stuff like that. But it definitely is starting to see that not all trades are created equal. Not all moves for players are created equal. I think it's a little, it's not a little. It's very concerning right now, the status that the league has and the amount of leverage that national team players of the United States have in terms of their moves. And I think it's become interesting right now, especially with this Press deal. We all knew that she very much enjoyed her time playing in Sweden. We know that her game just elevated to new levels when she went over there and really made the type of player who she is. Not to say that her time in Chicago didn't do that. She had a very successful run under Rory Dames playing for the Red Stars. But the fact that she is supposedly not going to be turning out for the Houston Dash, who's under a new head coach, really it's a brand new team for that matter, it's starting to raise some eyebrows, what this league could be looking like if this continues to go.
I mean, are we getting to a point now where the league is so, I wouldn't like to use the word desperate, I don't think that's fair, but where the league is so keen to keep its international players in the league that they are almost willing to bend over backwards to accommodate them? We obviously seen a player in Morgan Bryan, a young, very, very promising individual who's a Mac Herman Trophy winner. She's decided to leave the league, and obviously that made a lot of headlines. I'm not sure how close Kristen is to leaving the league. Obviously, there are reports out there that she has allegedly written down or spoke to the league about, or to US Soccer about teams that she would be willing to play for. My understanding, I've had some sources tell me that those teams were Utah, Seattle, and Portland. She was happy to play on the West Coast. Anywhere else, she's not so keen. How concrete that is, I'm not too sure. I think there are reports out there already that maybe say similar. But if that is a player dictating where she's going to play, is that the league being too accommodating to keep one of its stars, or should they continue to do what they're doing and allow players to have a bit more of a say?
I think it's the million-dollar question, right? It's the players that are on the national team that seem that they're the ones that are making a lot more moves happen than we would think. I mean, remember, the first year of this league, and this also goes the same back to WPS as well, there were players that were allocated, not by who it is, but it's by purely numbers on who went where. So, players put in preferences, that was taken into account, but at the end of the day, you were stuck on a team, there you go, obviously in Europe, never is going to be the case like that. But then again, you don't often see new leagues pop up every day. So there had to be some sort of way to start things off. But it's, I don't recall, Kieran, and you can refute me on this, but I don't recall too many trades that involve national team players that they're just like, okay, well, that's fine. If I'm going to be sent there, then so be it, whatever. It seems that a lot is going down to the preference of the player. Obviously, there are some, there's some, you know, things that we can throw out the door. Family is one. You know, coming off of a long injury and maybe just saying, okay, you know what, I might just want a fresh start somewhere else. Okay, so be it. But there have been a lot more moves lately saying that players just want to kind of get out if they don't like the situation, and they're the ones that are, you know, they're getting accommodated. So I guess to answer your question, is the league doing too much to accommodate? They are, they aren't. I'm starting to lean towards the former right now, but if this continues to trend like this, then yes, I'm going to say that there's a lot that's happening behind the scenes that I think there needs to be not so much transparency, but you know, we kind of need to get rid of all of that's in the closet and just open it out and say, look, the player, this is what the players are wanting and this is what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, and we have to, you know, we have to acknowledge that similar happens in the men's game. If a player has got his heart set on a move to a certain club, more often than not, because of player power, they are going to get that move because it's not in the interest of the club's, of the player's current employer to keep that player if they're unhappy. Now, I am not saying in any way that Kristen Press has demanded anything. You know, the one thing we don't want to do is go on hearsay or rumour. As I said, I've been told what I've been told. There are reports out there as well. But it's not just Kristen Press. We have, if you look at across the league, if you certainly look over the last couple of years, there was a period of time where the Boston Breakers didn't have an international on their team. Whitney Engen obviously was left out of Jill Ellis's squad after a period of time until Rose Lavelle came in. They had no US international. Before the trade happened with Sam Kerr and Nicky Stanton, the Chicago Red Stars and the Houston Dash, there was a very short period of time, granted, where the Sky Blue didn't have a US women's national team international because Kelly O'Hara was traded over to Utah. There was a period of time where the Washington Spirit were not overloaded with US international players. It seems to be that the same clubs can attract the international players in the US, and there are going to be times where other clubs are going to have to play catch up and look at other areas to try and strengthen their squad, because there does seem to be a preference for certain clubs in certain areas.
And I think the certain clubs, Kieran, we're going to fill in that little bubble right there, tied to MLS or other men's clubs, because they have resources. They've got training facilities that are, not to say properly funded for and properly maintained, but they're within the system that some of the quote-unquote independent teams, which, you know, you referenced the majority of them right there, they don't have those things. So yes, of course, that's going to be something that if you're any player, you're going to want the best of the best. Some clubs, they have it. Some, they are falling just a little bit short, but they're, it's not to say that they're not trying to get there. I mean, you tell me any, you know, anybody right now that doesn't want to have their home facility is the Maryland Soccerplex. That's probably one of, if not the best grass facilities in this entire nation. Any player would kill to have their home games there. But when you have the opportunity to play in Portland, where you have an owner in Merritt Paulson who has gone out and done just about anything for this women's game as possible, controversial at times, sure, but you can't fault the man for putting every ounce of resource that he has to making that team the best in the league. Any player's going to want to go play there. So, yeah, it's almost kind of like here in the United States college system across any sport. It's the facilities arms race. Whoever has the best stuff with them, that's going to attract the most recruits. Same thing the professional level. If you have the best environment, best training facilities, then the players are going to want to go there. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects into it. Family is one thing. And obviously, you know, when you mentioned Kristen Press and want to play the West Coast, she's a West Coast kid. You can't fault her for that a little bit. So yeah, it's interesting. It's very uneasy times right now. Not to say that there's ever been a smooth sailing moment for the National Women's Soccer League. Remember, the league is now 13 months without a commissioner. So that's something to address, because, well, there's no head at the ship at the moment. Yeah, but it's not the greatest of moments here in the league.
And that's the counter-argument, isn't it? What you just said a couple of moments ago was players want the best facilities, they want the best opportunities, and that's not unique to the NWSL. That's the same everywhere. Look at the number of players that have been attracted to Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City over here. Clubs affiliated with their men's side, clubs that have superb, world-class facilities that are available to their players every day. Look at in Germany that players have been attracted to Wolfsburg and to Bayern Munich. Look at the players in Spain that have been attracted to Barcelona, the players in France that have been attracted to Montpellier, PSG and Lyon. I am not criticising players for wanting to go to certain places. If that gives them the best opportunity, have the best facilities and the best day-to-day training, then I'm completely in support of that. I just think there is a problem when one of your international players has a problem and an issue with playing for a team. You mentioned MLS affiliated. The Houston Dash are MLS affiliated. So there is clearly something wrong that has happened there, because the Houston Dash are going to end up potentially out of pocket here, because they've lost Carly Lloyd, they've lost Janine Becky, and at the moment they have nothing to show for it.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, that's a challenging thing. They're working under a new manager as well, and Vera Paul, and you know, the limited conversation that I had with her at the NWSL draft, she seems excited for the opportunity. It definitely seems that the board in Houston is excited for her to be working there, kind of a little bit of a breath of fresh air manager there. I think the players are ready to work hard under her. But yeah, I mean, you talked about it, the MLS, an MLS organization, players don't even want to go there. Let's throw the Heat out of the window of excuses for that matter. We get it, Houston's hot. But yeah, that's a little bit concerning in its own right. So you brought up a good point there. It's again, it's all back to it's challenging. This is going to be another unique level in terms of the situations, how the league can respond to it. We haven't really heard anything from the league front and how they're dealing with this. And I would be surprised if we do hear anything before opening day, because again, remember, at time of recording, we're not that far off from the first game of the season.
We are not. And that's a good plug for our NWSL preview show. We're just going to do the one show this year. Over the past few years, we've done individual podcasts for every single club. I think based on the numbers last year, there was still a lot of interest, but I think it was probably a little bit of overkill to continue to do 10 separate shows, one for each club, or it would have been 9 this year. So we're going to do one, and we'll make it a little bit longer than our normal shows, and we'll cover it all off in one episode. So keep an eye out for that next week. And I think on that note, JJ, we will wrap up this episode. So thanks as always for joining me, pal.
Absolutely.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Really appreciate your time as always. Sorry it's been a little bit of time since the last podcast. But if you want to contact us, you can do. We're on Twitter on @WosoZone. To email us, you can do @WosoZone@gmail.com. You can listen to the show on iTunes or at womenssoccerzone.com, where, of course, we have articles and features and podcasts and everything there. So do go and visit. Thanks as always for your time. We appreciate it. Until next time, take care of yourselves and bye-bye.